Welcome to Medical Progress Today's Innovative Ideas series. I'm Paul Howard, the director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. Innovative Ideas is a series of podcast interviews conducted with doctors, scientists, health economists, and policy experts to get their thoughts on how we should reform our healthcare system in a way that promotes innovation, competition, and more affordable health insurance options. Joining us today on the Innovative Ideas podcast is Dr. Betsy McCoy. Dr. McCoy is a health policy expert and former Lieutenant Governor of New York State. In 2004, she founded the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths, a nationwide educational campaign to stop hospital-acquired infection. Dr. McCoy is also the author of over 100 scholarly and popular articles on health policy, including infection, medical innovation, the economics of aging, and Medicare. In 1994, her analysis of the dangers of the Clinton health plan in the New Republic won a National Magazine Award for the best article in the nation on public policy. Her writings have also appeared widely in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New Republic, Policy Review, Forbes, the New York Law Journal, and Los Angeles Times. Betsy, I know that things are moving very quickly in Washington these days, and you may not have a chance, and I don't know if anybody really has had a chance to dig into the details of some of the legislation that's coming down the pike. I understand Senator Kennedy issued at least an outline of his legislation today. But at least from what you've read in the news, what are the key elements of the health reform legislation as it's being discussed in D.C. that you would like us to focus on?
Well, the most important thing to know is that the health proposals that are taking shape intend to do more than help the uninsured. These changes will affect everyone. I'm stressing that because people have been promised that whatever legislation is passed will allow them to keep their own health plan if they like it. And that may be true. And for the fortunate majority of people who are well, they probably have little to worry about in the short run. But seniors and patients with serious illnesses will find a lower standard of care when they get to the hospital. And that's because the real emphasis now in Washington is not just on covering the uninsured. It's limiting what everyone spends on health care. You may recall way back on May 11th, and I say way back because things are moving so quickly, the president called on the health industry to cut the rate of growth in national health spending by 1.5 percentage points each year. And what was left unsaid there was that curbing medical spending will force cuts in hospital budgets, and it will spread nurses even thinner. It will reduce the number of diagnostic machines. It will cause waits for treatment. And in addition, slowing the flow of dollars into healthcare will depress the largest growth industry in the U.S. It's now 17% of GDP. So healthcare currently employs about 1.4 million people. That's 10 times the U.S. workforce at GM and Chrysler. So it's very important to understand what the implications will be of slowing spending growth in the biggest industry in the U.S. It will have implications for patients, for healthcare workers, and for the growth of the economy as a whole. And it's ironic that it's happening in the middle of a recession.
And to follow up on that point, I think a number of policymakers and policy experts look admiringly at Europe or the Canadian and UK systems and say what we really need to do is have more of that model where costs are contained at the center by government decisions who explicitly or explicitly make decisions about controlling costs and what kinds of new technologies are going to be developed. You take a very different approach, as you just suggested in your analysis of the problem. How should we as Americans be thinking about healthcare?
Well, first of all, we should not be thinking about it as a cost problem. It's much more constructive to think about it as a growth industry, as I just presented, because it is the largest employer in the U.S., the largest source of new wealth, and also the leader in the production of new technology in the United States. We're really world leaders in producing new medical technology, that's medications and medical devices and ways of treating illness. It's also really important to recognize that the alarmist language that's being used in Washington, skyrocketing costs, unsustainable spending, do not match the facts. If you actually look at the facts, you'll see that healthcare spending is increasing at far more moderate rates than it did in previous decades. Spending increased 10.5% a year in 1970, 13% in 1980. And for the last 5 years, it's been increasing at consistently less than 7% a year. And actually, it reached a new low of 6.1% a year ago. So it's really important to understand that we're not in the middle of a healthcare spending crisis. In fact, if you look at U.S. Commerce Department data, you will find that the average family is not being crushed by healthcare costs. Every year since 1960, food and energy together have taken up a declining share of Americans' expenditures, what Americans take out of their budget to spend, leaving Americans with more to spend on another necessity, health care. And these three necessities together have used up the same share of American spending capacity for decades, 39% every single year. So it's clear that this is not an undue burden on the average family. In fact, what you'll see is that the average family is spending an increasing share of its own pie on recreation. So, of course, averages don't tell the whole story, and families who can't afford health insurance should be helped. The poorest Americans, however, are already covered by Medicaid and other government programs. It's really the moderate low-income families who can pay for a routine visit to the doctor but may need help through a voucher or a refundable tax credit or a debit card, buying a catastrophic or high-deductible health plan, the kind of plan that would protect them in the event of an accident or unexpected illness. But we have to get away from thinking about healthcare as a cost problem the way Europeans do and think about it instead as our number one industry and the consumer's number one choice of where to spend their dollars.
So you, I think, are explaining that the U.S. is a very wealthy nation. We're an extraordinarily innovative nation when it comes to healthcare technologies. We ought to not surrender that lead in global medical innovation. But we do have a problem, or at least some sector of the population has a problem obtaining healthcare insurance, as you've just discussed.
And we can fix that relatively inexpensively.
So talk for a couple of minutes about what you see as the core of the problem. I think you just explained a little bit of it, and what your solution that you'd suggest would be for addressing that core group of uninsured that you think needs some help.
Well, if you look at the problem, and the U.S. Census Bureau gives us a lot of information about this problem. The U.S. Census Bureau claims that 47 million people are uninsured, but they're identifying themselves as being uninsured. 14 million of them are actually already eligible for government programs like Medicaid or SCHIP, that's for children, and they simply need to sign up. And another 10 million households have incomes over $75,000, and they've chosen not to buy insurance. So that leaves somewhere between 23.7 and 24 million people who need help affording insurance and would like insurance, or at least probably would like insurance. So that number, when I looked at that rang a bell, because that's about the same number of people who are helped by food debit cards. You may never have seen a food debit card, but these have replaced the food stamp program in all 50 states. Debit card technology has really transformed that federal food stamp program into a model of efficiency, even though it used to be notorious for fraud and abuse. A recent GAO study showed that 98% of people who are using these food debit cards are actually entitled to, they're eligible, there's almost no fraud. So these food debit cards are loaded each month electronically with a specific dollar amount of purchasing power depending on the size of the family and their income. And it allows these cardholders to go virtually anywhere to buy their food. You could use the same strategy to give families who need purchasing power to buy health coverage enough loaded on a card to buy a high deductible health plan. And that would be a very good thing to do, because it's a very good vehicle, because the debit card is flexible. After all, about 22% of people who are uninsured are going to be uninsured for a very short period of time. And the debit card would allow them to go buy coverage, catastrophic coverage, to cover them for that short period of time. In my view, these debit cards would be much better than a refundable tax credit, which is what's being widely discussed in D.C. right now by moderate reformers.
So the discussion, I think, is going in a very different direction, at least for the time being, than the one you suggested it should go in. For people who are concerned about issues of access and innovation, how can we approach the debate, and how can we change the debate towards these more targeted
solutions?
Well,
let me just finish this thing about the refundable tax credit. The reason a debit card would be better than a refundable tax credit is that some people don't file an income tax return, and amazingly, about half of Americans have no obligation to pay federal income tax. I mean, it's hard to believe, but they don't. So we wouldn't want to reduce that number anymore by giving them a refundable tax credit, where the debit card would not interfere with the tax system. So it's probably a very doable thing, especially since all 50 states are very practiced in using debit cards. Okay. So and the whole thing would cost somewhere about $20 to $25 billion a year. That's really small change compared with being discussed
compared with
in
everything else that we're
right.
doing. So and then how about changing the discussion to you know trying to do everything through a comprehensive quote unquote reform that we'll be living with unhappily for who knows how long, and your more targeted plan, how to change the conversation?
Well, let me share with you my thoughts on why they're going for the big overhaul, because the president's healthcare advisors are incredibly smart, incredibly well-educated. They know that 90% of the reason Americans spend more on healthcare than Europe is not because of waste, it's because of wealth. We have more wealth, and people choose to spend their wealth on healthcare. Okay. But they actually have a slightly different agenda, and if you read their writings, you will see that the problem they identify, and here I'm thinking particularly about David Blumenthal's work, the problem he sees is that as the nation's wealth increases and its standards of medical care become higher and more costly, the lowest income groups get pushed out. And in his writings, Blumenthal argued that government controls are needed to push down health care costs and, you know, by inference, standard of care, to a level that everyone, including the poor, can afford, or to what taxpayers can afford to provide to everyone equally. The goal in this reform is not only universal coverage, but also a similar healthcare experience for everyone regardless of ability to pay. And that's why there's such a push for this comprehensive reform. It's a social justice agenda.
But there's also an issue that innovation, as it comes out, of course, may start out expensive, but over time it becomes cheap as patents run out, as technologies become refined, so that the poor benefit by this rapid rate of innovation down the road. And there are other ways, as you define, to subsidize access to healthcare without slowing the rate of innovation.
Right. Not only that, but I regard innovation as cheap even at the beginning. It is amazing to see the strong bias against new technology in the administration. Doctors Emmanuel Blumenthal talk about that often. But even they admit that almost all of the annual health spending increases are due to new products. And the CBO confirms that. They say somewhere between half and two-thirds of annual increases in health spending are due to new products. You know, if you walk into an electronics store, you will see an array of products that didn't exist 20 years ago. And the same is true in a hospital. The treatments for heart disease and for stroke are so unlike care in the 1960s, for example, just as unlike care as a flat-screen TV is unlike that old black-and-white set people used to buy. And the remarkable strides. If you had a heart attack in the 1980s and made it to the hospital, you still only had a 60% chance of surviving till the end of the year. Now your chance is well over 90%. So, and your chance of surviving a stroke is more than double what it used to be. So slowing healthcare spending will inevitably slow this rapid pace of new innovation. People won't be buying new medical products every year. And that is really going to be a very serious problem for families dealing with incurable illnesses because, frankly, they go to bed every night hoping that the next day will bring a cure. And the cures are going to be much more slow to come if we put a lid on healthcare spending.
That's a terrific note on which to end our discussion today. Betsy, thank you very much for joining us.